And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when a new Wall Street Journal poll has just broken new ground, indicating a real problem for Joe Biden. Very deep and very concerning problem. We will get to that. There's also a real problem for somebody else who wants to be president, though not this year. It's Gavin Newsom of California. It's an unbelievable story, and it's worth some attention from people who live outside California. By the way, in the fantasy of this new movie, The Civil War, an Alex Garland movie, which is released today and has been getting mixed reviews, which I think is appropriate. One of the things that happens in that movie is that California secedes from the Union and creates an alliance with Texas. And there's a new American flag with just two stars, one for California, one for Texas. Now, you know this is a fantasy. Can you imagine, I mean, given the way they vote, Texas and California actually combining? This is not a serious prediction of something that will happen in the future. It does want to make a point about Americans being animated by this sometimes irrational, totally irrational hatred for one another. Usually irrational hatred for one another. Okay, here's a story out of California. California lawmakers don't know for sure how big their budget deficit is. How can they not know? But yesterday they decided it is big enough to go ahead and reduce spending by $17 billion. For that one state. The vote represents a preemptive strike from Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who's trying to get ahead of a shortfall that has been increasing every month and will likely extend into next year and beyond, when the second-term governor is widely expected to be eyeing a campaign for the White House. In his first term in office, Newsom enjoyed a series of historic surpluses and oversaw a vast expansion of government services. See, this is one of the core differences between Republicans and Democrats, and it really is fundamental. And in the first term in office, Newsom enjoyed a series of historic surpluses and oversaw a vast expansion of government services. If you were a Republican governor of California, I mean, even the last Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he was the most recent Republican governor of California, of course. In any event, if there were historic surpluses, wouldn't at least some of it have been given back, or most of it, or all of it, as tax reductions, with the idea that people really can spend their own money more productively than bureaucrats can, than the government can. He oversaw a vast expansion of government services, but that growth ended last year when the state had a shortfall of nearly $32 billion. Things got worse in January when Newsom announced another deficit of $38 billion. The nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office said the shortfall was actually $58 billion because they said Newsom should have included some reductions in public education spending. Then in February, the state updated its deficit estimate to $73 billion. After state revenues continued to come in below projections. This is not healthy, not positive. And speaking of not healthy and not positive, at least for the Biden campaign, headline, new Wall Street Journal poll, Biden has lost support among black men. And among black women, too. While most black men who were polled by the Wall Street Journal still said they intend to support Biden, some 30% said they were either definitely or probably going to vote for President Trump. Okay, you can say, well, wait, if 30% of them vote for Trump, that still leaves 70% voting for Biden. Yeah, but Biden didn't win by that much in these swing states. And this is, by the way, polls not of states like California, where it probably wouldn't be true that you're getting 30% of the black vote, but the swing states, the seven swing states, including states like Georgia, North Carolina. Biden, 30% said they were either definitely or probably going to vote for the former Republican President Trump. There wasn't a complete WSJ swing state polling from 2020, but Trump received votes from 12% of black men nationwide that year, as recorded by AP Votecast, a large poll of the electorate. In the Wall Street Journal poll, 11% of black women said they were either definitely or probably going to vote for Trump. In 2020, the AP poll found only 6% of black women nationwide backed Trump. So for some reason, the support for President Trump has just about doubled among black people in the last 4 years. Would that be enough to hand the election to Donald Trump? There's an editorial, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Patrick Ruffini. Ruffini is a founding partner of Echelon Insights, which is a Republican polling firm. And he has a new column under the heading Latino and Black Voters Could Elect Trump. What does that depend on? And what Ruffino is saying is that it's more than electing Trump. It's actually a serious rearrangement of our two political coalitions, the coalition on the right and the coalition on the left, and showing conservatives finally beginning to achieve something that conservatives had talked about and planned about and strategized about for years, which is to be more competitive among those large, quote, minority communities of black people, who are about 13% of the American public, of the population, of the voting public, whereas Latinos are now some 20% of the voting public. And Trump is actually close in a lot of the swing states to not just competing for Latino votes, but actually winning the Latino vote. So what's doing it? Why is Trump doing so much better? Well, this year he hasn't posted anything, and I hope he won't, about Cinco de Mayo. Remember when he did that during his first campaign and showed him enjoying a taco bowl?
Excuse me?
And yeah, that was right. And they didn't even serve it at his restaurant. But I don't think that's actually going to determine the Latino vote. We will get to that. And we will get to another big problem Biden has. And it's something that's supposed to be an advantage for Democrats. Abortion. We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show.
Your outlet for outrage.
It is outrageous what you are saying.
The Michael Medved Show.
This is outrageous.
Thank you.
And on the Michael Medved show, I mentioned right before the break that abortion, which is widely seen by Democrats as a magic golden ticket that's going to win them the Senate, and it's going to win them the House of Representatives again, and it's going to win them the White House again. The belief on the part of Democrats that abortion is magic is one of those things that it seems to me is worth challenging, because President Trump is clearly, I mean, say what you will, and I know that there are a lot of people who have dedicated their lives to the pro-life movement and are upset with President Trump because he seems to have basically ducked the issue. But it isn't that, because the one thing that people who have been oriented in the pro-life direction, like me, have said all along is the trouble with Roe v. Wade was it took the choice away from the people and away from the states. In other words, there's no reason to believe that as important as abortion policy is, as important as it is as an issue, as important as it is as a reality, why does it make sense that the people in Vermont should have exactly the same abortion policy as the people in Alabama? They're very different states, and there are very different feelings there. And the authority of American law, which you go back to the Declaration of Independence, it says to derive their just power from the consent of the governed. In other words, we believe that the source of power, the source of authority, the source of law comes from majority opinion. So with Trump's statement that basically this should go to the states and the states should make up their own opinions, and he did indicate that he was generally in favor of exceptions to abortion law to allow people in case of rape or incest or the life of the mother, that people should be able to, within those parameters, make that choice. And by the way, he has not indicated that he would insist upon that if states legislated in that direction differently. The difficulty with Roe v. Wade was it was based upon not the will of the people, even though certainly when it was first adjudicated, Roe v. Wade was popular, and then it was less popular. Now it seems to be popular again to have that idea. I do think that what is happening, okay, is with all of these various referendums that are going to be on the ballot, that the Democrats are pushing on the ballot, this will be to test their hypothesis that says that there's an overwhelming majority of Americans who want basically unlimited abortion or abortion with very few limitations. Actually, the polling shows that Americans are more in the middle. They would prefer abortions in some cases, but not in all, and certainly not in the late stages of abortion. And this is the one thing that President Trump, when he was talking about this issue, is misleading to people when he says that the Democratic position everywhere is always that you should have abortion through the entire course of pregnancy available to you. And again, if you're talking about protecting the life of the mother during the course of the entire pregnancy, that's a different thing than generally saying that, the Democrats now want to allow abortion even after the baby is born. In other words, infanticide. Chris Sununu, the former governor of New Hampshire, he's still governor of New Hampshire. He will be the former governor next January. But he's been campaigning around the country. He did very enthusiastically and often on this show for Nikki Haley. He was on CNN with Jake Tapper, and he made the problem that abortion could be a real problem for Democrats as this election unfolds. Listen, this is clip five.
You have some big races in New Hampshire that you want Republicans to win.
Well, I'll say this. I think it actually could be a bigger problem for Democrats. I really do. And I actually agree with the former president's position. It is now a state's issue. I mean, I wanted Roe v. Wade upheld and all of that. It wasn't. Now it's a state's issue. And I think what the former president is saying, hey, we don't agree with what's going on in Arizona. Let the voters of Arizona are going to have the opportunity to fix it. The voters in Florida, the voters of Texas, whatever your state is, that's where there's a lot of accountability in the system. The voters can change the legislature, have ballot initiatives, whatever it might be. And that's our new reality going forward.
And that's a reality which basically should be able to work this out without being more of a source of national division. A source of national division is the way that people are remembering the late O.J. Simpson. I've been a little bit amazed because really in recent years, we haven't heard that much about O.J. I mean, and it is fascinating that, and we have this in our newsletter. Newsletter's going out today. You can, that's totally free and totally available at michaelmedved.com. But there's reporting that shows that O.J. died with unpaid debts of $114 million. He died at 76. They're now saying it was prostate cancer that was the cause of death. Stephen Smith, sports commentator on Fox News, had this to say. Very controversial. It's clip seven.
If you were on this jury, finish the sentence.
Oh, he would have been under the jail. He wouldn't have got off, not if I was on that jury. There's no question about it. I mean, he was guilty as hell. The forensic evidence, the circumstantial evidence, and the manner in which the murders took place, it was clearly a crime of passion. And when you look at some of the things that they had articulated about his past, his relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson, some of the things that he had done to her, the Gloria Allreds and others obviously have spoken very eloquently about this over the years. It was clear that there was such a preponderance of evidence against him that, you know, he deserved to be in jail for the rest of his life at the very least.
Okay, and then the answer becomes, since this was such a strong conviction on the part of many Americans, how did it happen that what was not an all-black jury held this racially charged case in OJ's favor? Alan Dershowitz spoke about that. We will get to what he had to say coming up on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved show, talking about the O.J. Simpson trial, which took 11 months. And of course, it's the first major trial that was televised nationally at that kind of length with that kind of detail. And you may remember people made a huge deal out of it. They I think it was the Tonight Show. They had the dancing Itos because it was Judge Ito who was in charge of the trial, adding some flavor to the racial mix. It wasn't blacks and whites. It was blacks and whites and a Japanese American distinguished jurist. And The other thing that was fascinating to me, at least, reading a little bit about the O.J. Simpson trial, is that the judgment in which every single member of that jury found him not guilty of killing his wife, despite a tremendous abundance of evidence, they only took 4 hours, only 4 hours to acquit him. And was it all because if it doesn't fit, you must acquit? And something else I had not remembered, but have been reminded by some of the looking back at O.J., that it wasn't Johnny Cochran who had the idea of getting him in front of the jury to try on the gloves that they had found. It was actually... that was the prosecutors, and it was a huge mistake. It was not the defense attorneys, it was the prosecutors, because, I don't know, the gloves did not fit particularly well, or he wanted them exceptionally tight, or he was smart enough to show that he had a tough time putting them on, that they weren't made to fit like a glove. Alan Dershowitz was part of what they called the Dream Team, which was this collection of all-star attorneys who helped in the O.J. Simpson defense. So he came on Fox News immediately after Stephen A. Smith from the sports broadcaster had expressed himself and his certainty that that O.J. actually did murder his wife and her friend, Ron Goldman. This is what Alan Dershowitz had to say immediately after Stephen Smith.
The evidence was overwhelming. There was a mountain of evidence of guilt. There was blood evidence. There was DNA evidence. There was only one problem. The LAPD framed what they believed was a guilty man by taking one sock, and pouring the blood of O.J. Simpson and the blood of the victim on the sock. The problem is that the man who did it, Officer Van Adder, didn't realize that the blood he was pouring on the sock had a chemical in it called EDTA, which is not found in the human body, but found in test tubes. So we were able to prove conclusively that one piece of evidence, just the sock, had been tampered with by the government, and that created a reasonable doubt. And of course, Stephen A. is absolutely right. The LAPD was on trial. The predominantly black community and the jurors didn't trust the LAPD, and that's why it was so dangerous for Van Adder to try to enhance the evidence by creating that bloody sock. So the bottom line is the jury reached the right verdict. That doesn't mean that O.J. Simpson didn't do it.
It does mean that, to say that the jury reached the right verdict. What he's saying was that there were problems with the evidence, and again, that is a perspective that people will argue about. The one thing that was amazing to me is that O.J. actually did not seem to care about, quote, getting his reputation back, and didn't care that he became a punchline, really, for a murderer who literally got away with murder. And he even fed that status. Why? Because he wrote a book, said, "If I Did It," and in which he was talked about the way that he would have done if he had done it, because he was still denying that he did it. And that even though he was found in a civil case liable for the death of both Ron Goldman and for Nicole Brown Simpson. It's one of those things where almost every aspect of that case seems like it's from another world or from some kind of fictional story. And the funny thing was, when you look at some of the video that they play of OJ and doing interviews and being honored and being treated as such an exemplary human being, people talking about his character. He did spend 9 years in prison for stealing sports memorabilia that he thought belonged to him. And again, you think of the recklessness after you have been acquitted of murder, with at least a big chunk of the country still thinking you're guilty, and yet you get involved in this other argument and this other crime. It's actually a series of crimes about the burglary and the sports memorabilia. All terribly, terribly sad when you look at the amount of popularity and admiration that OJ, coming from a troubled background in public housing in San Francisco, that OJ exemplified at his height before the entire murder case. And oh yeah, the white Bronco. There is that. There's also a Michigan Kudz Day rally where protesters were chanting, well, one of their favorite slogans around the world. Speakers called to bring down the entire system of the United States, called for death to Israel and death to America. It sounded like this, which we can play. It's not numbered there, Jeremy, but you have it. Yes. Well, there's a Palestinian protester, another Palestinian protester named Ridhi Patel, and she threatened to kill Bakersfield, California Mayor Karen Goh, and explained why she was going to kill her in a psychotic rant during a city council meeting.
I'm here to speak in support. Hi there, my name is Ridhi Patel. I'm here to speak in support of the city council introducing a ceasefire resolution, specifically the one United Liberation Front has drafted. I don't have faith that you'll do this. You guys are all horrible human beings, and Jesus probably would have killed you himself. And the thing is, though, it's very clear to me as someone who's been an organizer for the past couple of years that none of you care, because you guys don't care about anything happening in Palestine or any other country where oppression occurs, because you don't care about the oppression occurring here. And I understand that you guys are all horrible people. You guys parade Gandhi around as a Hindu holiday called Chaitra Navratri. It starts off this week. I remind you that these holidays that we practice, that other people in the global south practice, believe in violent revolution against their oppressors. And I hope one day somebody brings the guillotine and kills all of you motherfuckers.
So what is the response for her? The response is dramatic. We will get to it. Coming right up on the MedVed Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, there is more of Ridhi Patel, who is a pro-Hamas protester, threatening to kill, as you just heard, the mayor of Bakersfield, Karen Goh, and other city council members in a psychotic rant during a city council meeting. And what's amazing is how quietly they're listening to all this. And she has a cheerful, kind of high-pitched voice and soothing in a way. But she's talking about threatening people with murder. And, oh, yeah, she was charged with 16 felonies and is being held on $1 million bail. Because when you go to a city council meeting and you threaten to come to people's homes and to kill them, well, listen, this is part of what Ridhi Patel had to say at the Bakersfield, California City Council.
Patel. I'm here to speak in support. Hi there, my name is Riddhi Patel. Because people actually don't care if you guys don't like them, and they're actually resisting, so you want to criminalize them. So regardless of whether you elect people into office, they'll backstab you, they'll let you die, and for that reason, you guys want to criminalize us with metal detectors, we'll see you at your house, we'll murder you.
Next speaker, please.
Lance, followed by Kev, followed by Valeria.
Ms. Patel, Ms. Patel, that was a threat, what you said at the end, and so the officers are going to escort you out and take care of that.
I'm sorry, it's not funny, because, again, political assassination is not unknown in the United States. And the idea that, yes, we can look at somebody's complete separation from reality, but this is going on everywhere. And in Michigan, in Dearborn, they had an Al-Quds Day rally. What is Al-Quds Day? Al-Quds means Jerusalem. And the Ayatollah Khomeini, who the original Ayatollah, who was the author of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, had set up Quds Day as a national holiday where people would be praying curses on the Jewish people and trying to erase any Jewish presence in Jerusalem, which is kind of hard because it was the city of David, and the first temple was there, and the second temple was there. I'll leave that aside. At Michigan Quds Day rally, the speakers talked out about bringing down the entire reality of Israel and America, and flew Palestinian flags, and you can hear them chanting, "Death to Israel and death to America." It sounded like this.
Gaza has shown the entire world why these protests are so anti-America. Because it's the United States government that provides the funds for all of the atrocities that we just heard about. And this is why Imam Khomeini, who declared the International Day of Quds, this is why he would say to pour all of your chants and all of your shouts upon the head of America.
Al mawti Amerika!
Al mawti Amerika!
Al mawti Amerika!
Al mawti
Amerika!
Malcolm X said, and I quote, "We live in one of the rottenest countries that has ever existed on this earth. It's not Genocide Joe that has to go. It's the entire system that has to go."
A Genocide Joe? Headline in the Detroit Free Press this morning. Organizers chants at Dearborn rally were wrong. Okay. The group that held a rally in Dearborn last week, during which the participants chanted "Death to America," said the anti-American remarks were wrongful and surprising, but it added that they will not back down from criticizing U.S. foreign policy. The statement was released after the "Death to America" chants drew widespread attention and criticism this week from Arab American leaders in Michigan, Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud, and the White House. The Al-Quds Committee did not identify who led the chant, saying only that it was a person unaffiliated and unknown to the Al-Quds Day event. It was a mistake for that brother to say that, said Abul Ghani, who was the head of the committee. But he added, "Was he wrong for being against the American oppression? No. We are all quite surprised when on the Al-Quds Day rally, someone who was in the rally started chanting 'Death to America,'" he said. We had never heard that on Al-Quds Day for a long time. Why would somebody do that on this day? Well, because the climate right now is hysterical. Osama Siblani, a longtime Arab-American advocate who is publisher of the Dearborn-based Arab-American News, called the failure of those leading the rally to stop the chants very, very stupid. It isn't just very, very stupid. It's very, very wrong. It's wrong. And again, the idea that you do, it's so very different from the rallies you'll see for Israel. And there are rallies like that where people are flying the Israeli flag, but they're also flying the American flag. The spokesman for the committee here in Dearborn said, "This isn't going to be me throwing a Muslim under the bus because I'm scared of Fox News. If they think that I'm going to start shaking in my boots and get scared, then they've got another thing coming." The October 7th attack on Israel was reported at an October 13th rally at the same location, also held by the Al-Quds Committee. The Free Press reported on that rally where Abdul Ghani and others voiced support for some of Iran's leaders. The late Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini started the tradition of holding what he called an Al-Quds rally in support of Palestinians on the last Friday of Ramadan when the controversial Dearborn rally was held last week. "The enemies, they think you Muslims are second-class citizens," he said. "They think you don't get to protest." No one has said that you don't get to protest. What people have said is that people should pay attention to the protest and see how people actually feel about the nation in which they're living. By the way, there's a photograph that appeared in the Detroit Free Press of the original rally that showed the Palestinian flags waving and one of the participants having a kafiyeh, traditional Palestinian scarf, around his neck, and he's holding up a big portrait of the Ayatollah Khomeini. The same guy who held the American embassy personnel hostage and basically destroyed the Carter presidency, but that was a different story. We do have a problem of national security and of having anti-American elements who are present in this country. And the question is, how do you deal with them? It's one of those things we'll be talking about with Andrew McCarthy coming up. He is a senior fellow at National Review Institute and an NR contributing editor. We'll also talk about what to expect in the upcoming hush money trial that finally begins tomorrow. The attempts that Monday, of course, they're not going to begin the trial on a Saturday. It begins the next time that we're going to be on the air. And that trial, which President Trump was very eager to postpone as much as possible, is going forward on Monday. And I believe Wednesdays they are taking days off from the trial, partially so that President Trump can have at least one day a week for campaigning. Biden campaigning more than that, but it may not help given the vagaries of the black vote and the Latino vote. We'll talk about all of that, plus a review of the new movie Civil War.